We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Well, good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Just before we get underway here, I do want to remind you that this is a time that we are talking about your support for the station and how important it is. We try to do that periodically throughout the year. We'll just be doing it today and tomorrow. We try to want to make this brief, but it is important that you remember just how important you are to the station, because so much of the support that pays for the programs that you enjoy, well, comes from people like you. It's a kind of a partnership. Your benefit is the programming that you enjoy. Something else we are really very excited about here is a kind of a partnership that we have going for this fun drive with the folks at the Common Ground Food Co-op, and they are going to donate the cost of 3 meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank for every pledge that WILL receives during this mini drive. So how much to pledge? Well, that's up to you. But that's something that we want you to keep in mind, that not only are you supporting WILL, but you're helping to support the work of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So the number to call is 217-244-9455. You can also do that online. You can go to willpledge.org, do it that way. Either way, your support to this station, very important. Well, we're also very pleased here to have on the program this morning, as our guest in the first hour, Allison Hedge Koch. She's a poet and has also done other kinds of writing as well besides poetry. She's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in the CAR reading series. And by the way, if you're interested in finding out more about the CAR series, visit the website of the University of Illinois Creative Writing Program. That's very easy to get to, and you'll find out about various kinds of things that they're involved in. She will be reading from her work this afternoon at 4:30, and that's in the author's corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. So if you're interested in hearing more from her and meeting her, you certainly can do that. She holds the Paul W. Reynolds and Clarice Kingston Reynolds Endowed Chair at the University of Nebraska Kearney, where she directs the Reynolds Reading Series, and also the Honoring the Sandhill Crane Migration Literary Tribute Retreat. She's authored 4 books, 1 chapbook, edited 8 anthologies. She's performed at the invitation of major poetry festivals around the world. She also has won a number of awards for her work, including the American Book Award. And she's here in the studio with us. And, of course, as we talk, questions at some point, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, I've been talking for a long time here. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing me.
Well, we're really, we feel fortunate that being at the university, a lot of interesting folks pass through here to talk about their work. And I'm pleased that some of the people we get to talk to are writers, people who write fiction and poetry. And particularly the poets, because I think that even people who are big readers, I don't think that they read a lot of poetry. And I think that that's sad. I'm sure poets think that it's sad that the audience for poetry is pretty small. And I suppose I've asked the question a lot of times of people who write poetry. Why do you think that is?
You know, Plato said that poets were dangerous and shouldn't be given any leadership roles. And we are sort of a colonized hemisphere here. We're not really post-colonial. And I think some of that Western thought has permeated in the United States for a god-awful amount of time now. In other countries, when you're reading poetry, you have audiences, 1,000 to 6,000 people, and poetry's everywhere. It's in the streets. It's a major portion of the book sales, even in airports in other countries. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. is unique in that respect, that poetry is not well-received or well-known in this country. Some of it also has to do with the education system, with so many educators not having been versed in poetry while they were coming up in school. They're uncomfortable teaching it. And so that sort of permeates this idea that it's for the few and far between roles of readers. It's sort of like jazz, and this has been said many times. There's a shelf, and people who know jazz get jazz, and they go directly to that shelf in the music store, and they listen to those stations, like this station, I'm sure, that plays very wonderful jazz often. And there are people that look at poetry that way, and they shelve it in very small selections in stores, and people that know it go there and read it, are well-versed in it, and stay within their own secluded sort of world of reading. It's a bit of a tragedy. And poetry is the basis of all good writing. And for anyone studying writing, for anyone out there that intends to write at some point in time, learning poetic technique is essential to good writing. It's the base of it. It's the blood and guts of writing when it comes down to it. Good prose is very poetic oftentimes, and there's a relationship there. Unfortunately, it just has been this way for a while, and hopefully it is changing. And we have a president now who had a poet speak at the inauguration, which has only happened three times in the history of U.S. presidents. And, of course, we always have a poet laureate. But hopefully, you know, there'll be some sort of change to maneuver more broad-reaching poetics in the education system, but also just in the regular communicative processes in the States. I'm looking forward to that conversation.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I know about you is that you've been a songwriter.
Yeah.
You know, it sort of strikes me, well, I always think of, well, a song is a poem
it's
set
true.
To music. So in that sense, we're
true.
Exposed to it a lot. But
it's
I don't
true.
Think people, I think people see those as two very different things.
Yeah, it's true. I started out writing lyrics and worked as a songwriter for a number of years. I was always writing my poetry that I would say, you know, stands as a genre of poetry on the side, but not as public with that for many years until I attended the Institute of American Indian Arts and was convinced by the professors there to own up to the literary side as well.
Yeah,
I had to be pushed and coerced myself.
Well, I have heard you say in an interview that I listened to, where you were talking about your writing, that writing was something that you always did. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you can actually think back to the very, very first time that you really got started in doing writing and what the impulse was.
My sister and I were very intentional about learning the alphabet. She's 3 years older than me. Because we saw it as a way to reach out to one another and to communicate in a different way. We were interested in the symbolism of the alphabet and the symbolism of written language at a very early age, and so we were purposeful about it. We weren't necessarily looking at it as something that was just sound-related, but we were very interested in the sounds of things and communicating with each other without anyone knowing what we were up to. And we grew up in a family that was heavily versed in oral traditions. My father is a great storyteller, as is most of his family. And my mother is quite schizophrenic when I was a child. And some things were safe to have his conversation in a room with her while she was episodic, and many things were not. And so to distance ourselves from this sort of chaos of madness in the house, it became not just an entertainment factor, but a survival factor for us to communicate through story, through song, through poetics, on the page, when we couldn't necessarily be verbal in the house. We started out, I remember clearly, you know, writing with burnt matches on the back step and using that instead of, you know, pens or pencils, really, but just writing things out with burnt matches or crayons or sometimes chalk rock, whatever we had, pieces of sheetrock broken off and composing stories to one another or filling in lines. Now, my sister remembers this slightly different. She is 3 years older. And she remembers that I taught myself to read and write to keep up with her. But I clearly remember her telling me how things sounded and how they fit together. Right. So, but the impetus was there. And we just thought that that's what people did because we were, you know, being raised in a family where there was a lot of story, there was a lot of song. We just thought this is something humans do. And we will grow up and do these things as well. We never really considered an option. So it was always there, and I was always writing. I went through some periods of pretty pathetic shyness when I was a young child, and going between that and sort of class clown or fisticuffs, and those were my three options. So I either could, you know, just be invisible, or I would clown and try to take weight off of someone who was maybe going through a taunting or something, or I would fight. And to get through any of those avenues of communication or lack of communication ability, I was always writing and communicating with my sister or with close people or to myself, just as an engagement of survival. And wasn't really open with the writing until I hit maybe second grade in school. I published a few things that year, and then I withheld again. And in sixth grade, and this is in the memoir I'll be reading from this afternoon, there was a period of time where an English teacher was giving me A's in the class and whatnot, and I wanted an A+, and I also wanted her to read this book I had written, which was the first memoir I wrote in sixth grade, and I think it was almost 300 pages typed, and I turned it in and asked for extra credit, and she said, "Well, you already have an A," and I said, "Well, I want an A+. Will you read it?" And she came back after the weekend and had people from a local high school and a community college. It was not too far away, but it was a driving distance there in her classroom, and she wanted me to talk with them about taking these advanced classes. And she thought she had discovered this 11-year-old novelist, and the information that I had written was all true, and it was all very personal about our house and our home life with my mother's schizophrenia. It was called Diary of a Mad Housewife's Daughter. The movie was out that year, and of course, it was a mature audience only. You had to be 17 to get in, so I had no idea what the movie was for Diary of a Mad Housewife. But I thought, well, I can write Diary of a Mad Housewife's Daughter. And they loved the book. I panicked because it was unaffordable information that they had. And it was very dangerous to our family, and oftentimes we were fostered out, as it was because of my mother's insanity. So I grabbed the text and ran home and burned it and didn't go to school the rest of the school year, which was only a couple of weeks.
But, so they thought that you had made this up, but
they
in fact,
it was a novel.
this was the truth. Yeah. You were just writing what had happened to you.
It was my first memoir.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let me just mention, for people who are listening, that our guest, Allison Hedgecoke, is here visiting the campus. She'll be doing a reading this afternoon on the U of I campus. This is part of the Carr Reading Series this afternoon at 4:30 at the Author's Corner at the Illini Union Bookstore. One of the books from which she'll read is her memoir, which mm-hmm. is Rock, Ghost, Willow, Deer, mm-hmm. which is the story of her growing up. And lest anybody think that you're being metaphorical talking about your mother having schizophrenia, she, in fact, truly was seriously mentally ill.
Oh, yeah.
And that living with her was a big thing that sort of shaped your childhood, and
sure.
You write about in a very plain and kind of painful, I shouldn't laugh, painful to read way in
Hopefully
the memoir.
There's some levity in there too.
And so she'll be reading from that book, and also read some poems from her collection, Blood Run. And anybody who is in and around Champaign-Urbana should feel free to stop by. Well, you've been talking for a while here, and I think I should ask you to read something.
Oh, okay. Actually, if it's okay, I'd like to read from Blood Run, if I can.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, Blood Run is a verse play. It's a collection of poems that are all in persona. I worked for about 7 years to lobby for a mound city in eastern South Dakota, western Iowa, that was seriously overlooked and neglected and just, you know, quite erased for the most part. This is a city that in the 1700s, when the French came through, they took a census. There were six nations living there speaking at least six languages. There were other tribes there visiting as well or trading. But there were 10,000 people living in the city at the time. And of course, to bring people from Europe and convince them that people are nomadic and the lands are up for free, you can't really admit that there's cities there. I have a little house. My youngest son and my grandkids live in about 10 minutes from this site. And I was teaching for Indian Ed in the school district there, and I could not work in that area without speaking to this site or trying to pay some tribute to it. So I lobbied for about 7 years for the site to be recognized and acknowledged. In the meantime, writing a verse play to attend to the site, the mound site that's there. And I'll also be reading from this afternoon. I'll read a short poem from it. And everybody has voices. The looters have voices. The Jesuits that come through have voices, as well as all the protagonists of the site. And this is Ghost. When all the dog hair, squirrel tail, fox tail, porcupine, buffalo, and pony grasses run, impressions strummed along the slopes, gradient rise. When mullein presses low, red willow limbs quiver, whirlwind shiver, release silver spotted skippers, monarchs, white butterflies, take to wing, to firmament, lifting miracle, commotion, phenomena now we. In the translucency of leaves, overcast sun, rolling, lightning, shadowing, breadth of green, in this acuity, this keenness, insight pronounces utterances, not unlike prophecy, for those who heed, prefigure, perceive, for those who distinguish modern from manifest, in everything all familiar, we will have beckoned you to return to us, return our skeletal remains to shelter here, return our longing. Then in quiet, whispering, momentary stillness reveals.
It seems to me that one of the things that's really strong in your writing is sense of place. I mean, the way that evokes the places. And how do you, and I wonder how you think about that or how that happens, or maybe it's just an automatic thing that happens.
I remember one time doing a colloquium at a university, and a question had been going on with several panels before it was my turn to speak that had gone unanswered until then. And they said, how is it the writers center themselves in the past when they move into a new place? And, of course, we're always replacing unknowns with knowns. So when we get somewhere to make ourselves feel familiar, our past becomes very keen to us and very accessible because we have to have a relative factor that we can rely upon to make free associations to what we're faced with. When I arrived in that area, the thing that centered me in that place, the thing that gave me a right to live in that area to make me feel at home is we're descended from mound builders as well. And this was a mound city. So in my childhood, when my father would take us to particular mounds and story us in that knowledge or that place, that was with me. So in the sinew, I carried it with me wherever I go. When I arrived in this place and found out that there was mound cities here as well, they've just been relatively erased. I suddenly was adapted to the place or adopted the place in such a way that I felt I could have a kinship there and allow myself to be grounded or to work there. And I think it's important for most people, especially those people like me who have wanderlust and continue traveling always, to find those relative factors of place and to be able to endow oneself within that or center oneself within that, not just to reach the work and make it available, but also to have something to say that's meaningful and to find out what needs to happen in that particular place or what you can actually offer to that place that's not already there. Everywhere you go in life, every place that you are, there have been tens of thousands of people before you, and there will be tens of thousands of people after you. So in that place and time, what is it that you can do to make a ripple or to offer something or to attend to something that's been unrecognized? And I think for me, that's how place works. So allowing it to affect you to a degree that you suddenly have impetus from which to work. I hope that's helpful. Mm.
We need to take just a moment here
Okay. And
to pause in our conversation because we would like to ask people to support the station. And then we'll talk some more with
our
guest, Allison Hedgecoak. And I have a caller here, and my apologies for making the caller wait, but it'll take a minute or two. Then we'll get back into our conversation. Here in studio with me is Dave Teal. He is the program director for WILL-TV. When we do these things, we go back and forth. We go upstairs. We go downstairs. And I'm real glad that you could be here and spend a little time with us and talk to people about supporting the station.
No, it's great to be here. I'm always glad to help out. And, you know, it's so important that we hear from our listeners. I mean, in a number of ways. We love to hear when I've guest hosted the show, I appreciate always having the comments and questions from listeners. But at times like this, when we're in a pledge drive, obviously, you know, we're looking for listener support. And that is, I think, the important part of this partnership. Because public radio is a partnership between us and the people at home, people at work, people in their cars. So what makes you become a contributor? Well, you know, we hope that you have a desire to make a difference in your community. We hope that you have a desire to hear from interesting people, from voices that you might not otherwise be exposed to. And when you do make that contribution today, there's an added benefit. We have made a partnership with the Common Ground Food Co-op, And they will be donating the cost of three meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank for every pledge that we receive. So your pledge not only helps support all the programming here on WYLL AM, but will also help through the Common Ground Food Co-op to donate three meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank and helps feed some hungry people. That's, of course, very important right now. We need to hear from you. Contribute by calling 217-244-9455, and you can also go to willpledge.org to make an online pledge.
Yeah, and we have heard from, as of 10 o'clock, we've heard from 37 folks. We had 37.
Oh, no, we're up to 49 now.
Great, 49. Okay, I was a little behind.
So just under 150 meals being provided by the Common Ground Food Co-op.
All right, again.
So that's terrific.
Well, we want to say thanks to all the people who have contributed, and we certainly want to say thanks to people who have been very loyal supporters of WILL for a long, long time. And I know that there are a lot of these people who have been very generous and very loyal. So to those folks, for your continuing support, we want to say thanks. We couldn't do it without you. And if you have never supported the station before, well, this would be a great time to do it.
We hope you'll call 217-244-9455. Don't put it off. We're only here. We're going to be doing a three-day pledge drive, and that's it. This is day one, but don't wait till day two or day three. Just do it now.
All right.
Thanks.
Thanks, Dave. Well, let me again introduce our guest for this hour, Allison Hedgecoke. She teaches at University of Nebraska, Kearney, where she directs the Reynolds Reading Series. She's also taught and read from her work a lot of other places around the world. She's performed at the invitation of major poetry festivals. She has written a number of collections, published a number of collections of her work. Her poetry also has authored a memoir, Rock, Ghost, Willow, Deer. She's been the recipient of a number of awards, including the American Book Award. And I think that was for your very first?
It was election. For the very first.
The very first one. Mm-hmm. She's here visiting the campus as part of the Carr Reading Series. And she will read from her work this afternoon, 4:30. This is in the author's corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. And, of course, anybody who is interested in hearing her and seeing her can stop by. And if you'd like to find out more about the Carr Reading Series, the easiest thing to do would be to visit the website of the Creative Writing Program mm-hmm. at the U of I within the Department of English. I have a caller here who has been patient, and we want to get to them. Somebody on our toll-free line, line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. I gave during Bob McChesney's last pledge drive, I guess, and got the excellent Kevin Phillips book. So I encourage people. It's a great collaboration with the food bank, too. I wanted to ask you sort of a general question about the idea. There's a great French word, and I think you're partially Canadian, engagé, the idea of poetry as engaged, and some people call it political, but just basically the idea of having some kind of social conscience. And I mean, we have the example here in the U.S. where there was an attempt to have a poetry reading at the White House during the Bush era, and it actually didn't happen because the poets refused to not read their poems that related to the war of the day. But so I just want to know, I'm sure it's no less of an influence in Canada, and being First Nation also must make you politically engaged too, I would think. So if you could just generally talk about that, and just as a throwaway line, what's up with Harper proroguing the parliament twice in a year? I haven't heard much coverage of Canada, but it's a 17th century device that's used rarely, I guess. But that's, you don't have to respond to that, though. You might mention Harper. I don't know. Thank you very much.
All right.
Well, I'll talk a little bit about engagement. And, I oftentimes when I speak or lecture places, one of the talks I give is on literary activism. And I do think that any person who is working in a creative field also carries some level of consciousness. Oftentimes that creates a good place for social involvement. I was, coincidentally, called by Sam Hamill during the Bush era when they turned down the invitations of the White House to join in with him, and actually ran some of the Poets Against the War readings that in South Dakota at that time. I was the host of the readings that were in that state at that time, and have, I'm friends with Sam and have worked with him, and we've actually toured together and read together in Venezuela and in Colombia. And, these things have to happen at times. And the real problem with that was Laura Bush coming out and saying that Not only were poets disinvited after some refused to come, but she also said that poets were not allowed to write about political features of the country. Coming from a librarian, this seemed very strange and ridiculous, and somebody had to take a stand about it. And you know, it was tens of thousands of poets involved in this activity. Recently in Canada, we had there was a festival at Toronto that dealt with U.S. politics as well as a festival in raising consciousness about the Cuban Five that are held here in prisons in the United States. And I'm bringing up a Cuban poet to D.C. We're all doing Split This Rock this year at D.C. in March. You can look it up online at splitthisrock.org. Several of us are feature poets speaking about what needs to happen as far as, you know, poets can do, speak to this voice of world change and to try to encourage people to come into more thoughtful processes in organizing what happens with the funds that we have as nations, U.S., Canada, and a lot of political powers around the world to feed, clothe, and house people rather than to continue the bombing. But I think, you know, for the most part, this spreads across the arts as disciplines, and for many, many writer, artists, musicians, composers, there's a need to have a place to live and to work and to breathe freely. So it's a pretty normal portion of what creative people are usually doing is to find that liaison where we can find common ground. That's one of the purposes of the arts. A good pitch for the station's fundraising today for that willpledge.org is you're funding people to come into the station who are living in that consciousness, and the work is about that consciousness. And so we're living in that, and that tends to be our thread of compulsion, and to embed or ground us in the work that we're doing. And those people speaking from cultural aspects or attending to our own cultural embodiments, it's the same. It's the same course of duty or responsibility, cultural duty, if you will. And hopefully we can make a wave there and create some sort of conversation and a place for these things to occur. I hope that helps a little bit.
Again, questions from other people who are listening are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I read an interview that you gave a few years back, and something that you said just jumped off the page at me. And what you said was, and it makes me think about, you know, some of the difficult things that you have written about your own life. What you said was, writing is therapeutic. And you said, coupling the beautiful and the horrendous allows one to cope. And I liked that very much. And I think that says a lot in just a few words.
And the concept for me, as far as coupling the beautiful and the horrendous, this is it's what we do. If we're not learning from something that's oppressing us, if we're not learning from something that's damaging us or causing us pain, if we're not transitioning that into something that's sort of glorious, then we're not coping. We're allowing that to sort of end our possibilities, and it becomes an absolute. And in life, humanity, we sort of gauge ourselves by these markers. Our memories, our keenest memories, are the glories in our life. You know, for some guys, it tends to be their high school years. I don't usually hear women talk about their high school years, but it tends to be glory days or the glory memories. And the rest of our markers are all, you know, what happened that was bad. And we live somewhere in between those knowns. And so for me, coping is really about threading them together and allowing that sort of glorious avenue to uplift or sustain us during the period of drama or tragedy.
Well, would you read something else?
Sure. Clan Sister, and this is from Blood Run. They curse themselves each time they approach this place with the sentiment of animus. Winds, round, puffed heads intrude. No rest will come to those who take the troves this place embraced. No rest, no peace, no honor follows those who rob these stores. The chevrons in their pockets are still able. In their blindness, they presume and concoct story of a wild man, wild woman. Our home is wilderness. denigrates the realness and elevates their stature, yet as nature is our mother, they imprecate themselves alone. River will come for them. She only rests till time needs her to bathe, wash over. Without offerings, she will come swollen, snatch them up like pollen, disperse, dispense, derogate. Wet earth profuse once more.
Are there, do you think, particular sensibilities that shape the work that come from the place that you were born, from your dad, particularly from people who were important influences as you were growing up?
Yeah, definitely. My father was a major influence in my life, as was his family. Our relations on that side were very important to us. Everything that was going on in our house, and there was a lot going on, everything was sort of markered with this wonderment of who we were and where we came from and these tens of thousands of generations that were with us at any given time. And we were raised to believe in this, you know, and now we speak of it as DNA. As children, you know, we talked about, you know, this is our blood memory and this is who we are. And we have all of these abilities because all of these people we descend from had abilities in these different areas. And so if you wanted to do something, you would just think about this particular person who had lived you before you. And hopefully that offering would be there and allow you to grace yourself in whatever you were being tested with. He also absolutely loved my mother, and they're still together. He's 88, she's 89. For most schizophrenics, they're abandoned. They end up on the street and forgotten and die young. I'm collecting an anthology of writer children of the chronically insane, and there are many. And I'm the only person in the book whose same parent did not leave the insane parent, and usually they left the insane parent with the children. My father said, you don't leave someone who's sick. She's not picking up a bottle and drinking. She's not doing this to herself. She has an illness. It's in her brain. And you do not abandon someone who's sick, and that is your mother. And he had an uncanny ability to rise above the situation, even when she was violent, no matter what was going on. And she was quite often, many, many times during the day, episodic in screaming and yelling at her delusions. The buggers were their names. And he never reacted to it. We never saw him react to her insanity. And so we had this marker of my father. And he always says, you know, for us, there didn't need to be a feminist uprising because the men of our people were always that in the respective women. And so for him, it was a natural thing to have respect for her, especially because she was sick. And in so much, we learned tolerance, we learned patience, we learned endurance, and we learned to find other things to create a distance between what was happening physically and where we were mentally and emotionally. And so cultural grounding was essential to us in our development as children. And I think it absolutely gives us place and grounding in all situations. I tend to be very, very good in crisis situations. I tend to be the person to get everybody out of fires and whatnot, ambulance activity. I'm the one that always calls no matter how many bones I have broken. I usually don't realize I'm wounded until everyone else is attended to, and then I can feel things. And I think that really comes from him and his cultural nuances. So I'm indebted heavily. Yeah.
The kind of things that you have, that you talk about, and that you wrote about in Rock, Ghost, Willow, Deer, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of families, these would be big secrets. The thing would be, we don't talk about this mm-hmm. outside of the house. And it sounds as if actually your parents, even your mom, were okay with that. And it seemed that she was saying, well, you know, that you wrote what was and kind of honored you for actually telling the truth that way.
Well, it's kind of funny because I was attacked by several people for writing the memoir, which was odd to me because I'm an older woman. So you can write your life if you want to. But I went to my mother before I released the book, and the book did sit on the shelf for 8 years after the time I composed it until the time that I offered it for publication. But I went to my mother and asked her if she was okay with it. And she read the manuscript, and she said, you know, I was, it's your life. You're a writer. That's what you do. Of course, you're going to write your life. And, you know, she still believes in her delusions, but she doesn't have to respond to them because she's lost the brain chemistry in her age that causes this compulsory argumentative factor of the schizophrenia. So she still believes in all of the things that she always believed in, but she doesn't war with it anymore. But she knows that I'm outside of that now. And when I was young, she couldn't tell the difference. And she says, "You're a writer. That's what you do. You have to write it. It's your truth." And she goes, "I was really crazy, you know." I know that. And the other thing that it's really gifted me is that, we were talking before we started talking to the audience here. Maybe I could tell them a little bit about it. My father's culture, our family culture, my mother's as well for that matter, also gave us this grace in understanding place where we are. And I'm working in Kearney, Nebraska, and I have a position there at Kearney, University of Nebraska. And it happens to be in the epicenter of the sandhill crane migration. Mm-hmm. So it's the largest concentration of any furred or feathered creature on Earth. Every year, it's been going on for 60 million years. The cranes are now what they were then. The skeletal remains from 60 million years ago are the same as they are now. So they have not had to evolve. They are what they are. And it took the job there. They asked me why I would work there. And I said, because of the cranes. And they said, "We have cranes." I said, "Let me do a conference there to pay tribute to that." The sandhill cranes have affected tribal peoples all through their migratory route in North America and over the tundra and into Siberia. Indigenous people have been affected by them lingually, physically, culturally, dance-wise, even riding. Crane clan of Anishinaabe people, another nation, their riding all comes from Crane clan people. It's crane-influenced. The symbolics of that riding are all crane-related. On the birch bark scrolls, which were hidden from Europeans when they came into this area. And we're reconditioning ourselves to look at that manifestation of that effect of the cranes on the culture as well. So yes, people within the culture affect you, but the culture itself is endowed with and informed by place. And we're an audience for everything that lives in that place, the other peoples, the other animals that live in that place, as well as plant life and geographic features. And the cranes have been a heavy, heavy influence on Native people for eons and eons and eons. So we do have a conference there every year during the crane season. And right now they're at 600,000. They were down to 5 mating pair at one time because of U.S. Propriety toward extinction. And they've regenerated themselves. Nebraska's protecting the bird. And one of the professors here, Leanne Howe, who is in English and also in American Indian Studies, is a UNK Crane Fellow. So we are very fortunate to have her work with us every year and actually is co-hosting with me. And it's a wonderful conference. So if you're interested at all, and you guys should take time to come out, mid-March is the greatest peak, and that's when we have our writer retreat. We bring out many Indigenous writers, U.S., Canada, also South America, to come in and convene, witness the cranes, look at how those dances, the different chortles and purrs and maneuvers, mechanisms of the culture of the cranes when they come there. It's an annual council that they have. It's actually their staging ground, and pick their leadership for the year, gather themselves together to go to All Points North, and to remember that these influences came from place, came from other animals, that we're borrowing them in order to cope and survive in this life. And so what we've learned in the culture from many different nations of animals or plants has actually allowed us to cope as human beings and to have sustenance as human beings. But there's a wisdom there. So it all goes together. These things.
For anybody who's just tuned in, I want to again introduce our guest, poet Allison Hedge Koch. She teaches at University of Nebraska, Kearney. She's here visiting the campus and to take part in the CAR reading series. And you can hear her, meet her, and she'll be reading more from her work this afternoon at 4:30. This is in the Author's Corner in the Illini Union Bookstore. And of course, it's open to anybody who would like to hear her. We have a little bit more time here. Something I wanted to ask you about, maybe this was a little bit more technical, but I know you've talked about with your work, with your writing, wanting to give it the time that it takes, and that sometimes maybe you're working on something and it's not what you want it to be, and so you just take and you put it aside, and it can sit for a while. Mm-hmm. How do you know when something is finished?
I think at some point in time for me, and this is very specific to each writer and very specific to each artist or each composer, I think for me, I never really believe things are finished. I continue rewriting after something's published. So the first time I publish something, it may come out in one form. And then the next time it's reprinted, I may have changed something. I often ad lib or go ad hoc at readings and change. And people following along in the books get very perturbed with me. But I think it's a living thing. And, you know, that poetry and story changes each time you bring it to voice again or you read it again. And so I don't really feel that things finish that way. But when I let them go for publication is when I feel it's at a state that I've taken as far as I can at that time. And it maybe needs to be out in the world and have its own life out there beyond me for a while before I figure out what else I want to do to it. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I'm waiting for exchange, a little bit of, you know, if you will, audience feedback even. Sometimes somebody will come up with something after a read or a critic will write something and it'll cause me to go back and change it because it's absolutely not what was intended. Or I get inspired by it and think, okay, I'll incorporate that a bit. It just depends. But I don't really think things finish in that way. I don't look at things as final or ending.
Yeah. Yeah. When you make changes, is it usually big changes or would there be something where a reader would say, where you might change something small and a reader might say, well, I don't see exactly what the difference is there?
It's pretty subtle most of the time, although there have been a few times I've made some major shifts, yeah. Yeah. But most of the time it's fairly subtle. Somebody following along while you're reading would get very upset. But sometimes I do it if the audience is not paying attention. And I see them following along in the book, and I'll just change the lines intentionally to get them to look up. And then I'll read, you know, as it's written in the book. Because we're in conversation with each other, you know. The audience and the writer are in conversation with each other, particularly at a reading performance.
I guess I never really thought about that very much. So how you're as you read, you're trying to tune into what you can see, or what is it that you're getting from the audience, or what is it you're trying to read in the people who are listening?
I really believe it's a conversation. And whenever I go to read somewhere, if I didn't think that, I'd probably hate reading because it'd be just reciting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm very active and hopefully, you know, bring that to the podium as well. But I usually feel the room when I come in and I'll get an idea or what feels to me as though somebody needs a particular thing and I'll generate the reading accordingly. I often don't really prepare a straight reading before I come. I come in with the work in front of me and read depending on how I feel the room needs to have that space filled at that particular point in time. And as I said, if somebody's not paying attention, I'm liable to switch things up a bit to make sure they're there with me so we can have an engagement. You know, I really feel that the reading performance space is for that. It's audience engagement. It's their time to walk away from something in their life and live in another world for a little while, you know, and be moved in some way. They want to be moved. And so it's my job to do that. In order to do that, I have to be focused on what the audience brings as well, emotionally, mentally, hopefully, you know. It's a bit of gifting on my part, I hope, and essential, I think, for the reading to actually be a successful reading.
Yeah. We, you know, when you talk with writers, I guess that you have to have some sort of shorthand. People get labeled and they get put in certain categories. And so either with genre or the fact that someone does fiction or creative nonfiction or poetry. And then I'm sure that if you hear someone works in some particular way, then that means, I guess, you have certain expectations of who they are and what they're going to do. And I wonder, you know, for you to be. And I know you've done different kinds of writing, so you're not just a poet. But if that's the primary label that gets slapped on you, are there things that in one sense you'd say that works for me to be said poet Alison Hedgecoke, or that either it works for you or that it doesn't?
It's just a different hat, as they say. I think it's okay. Whatever they want to call me is fine. I'll still get the work done. You know, I do also write fiction, but I'm very stingy with it. It tends to be my playground and where I work out sort of my own demons. And so I'm very, very stingy about publishing the fiction. But I also write fiction. People don't usually recognize me as a fiction writer. This is kind of interesting to me because I probably write as much fiction as I do poetry, if not more. But I'm not publishing it, so how would they recognize me that way?
Well, in a particular interview that you did that I heard, you said actually that there's sometimes people just don't. They don't want to accept the idea that you could both write poetry and write fiction that say, oh, no, you're a poet. You can't do that.
That's that U.S. compartmentalization problem. Everything has to fit somewhere and be categorized, and that's the only feature it's allowed. You know, it's tunnel vision. And that's another problem we have with poetry not being as widely read as it should be. It doesn't fit within the categorization of mainstream, and so it's pushed over into its far-reached corner and gathering cobwebs, which is, you know, it's a crime, actually. It's really terrible. But there is that problem. And I think most writers have to have some trouble with label. I don't have trouble with people calling me some. I have trouble with actually trying to fit into that mode or be what they expect me to be. And so I just show up as who I am. I think for the most part, though, poetry is, again, it is the sort of breath or the life through all of the work. And so in some ways, to be categorized as poet is actually attending to those other genres as well. Mm-hmm. I did publish for a number of years under my initials, A.A. Hedgecoke, if I was doing other genre work, because it allowed me to get to other editors and push the work through without it being poetry. I also publish some things in Canada I don't publish in the U.S., like children's stories I've done in Canada quite a bit, because that would be another tangle. Oh, my gosh, poets now publishing children's stories. What will we do with this? Yeah, so I will publish them in Canada and use, you know, code name or whatever and do it that way. Yeah, so we have to do what we have to do to get the work out when it comes down to it.
Yeah. I think that maybe one of the things that people that find difficult and maybe also attractive about poetry is I think more than other kinds of writing, there's something very mysterious about it, I guess. And I feel that, you know, and maybe this is not the case, but sometimes I feel like it's more of a window into the writer than maybe other kinds of writing. Now maybe that's not true at all. Do you think that is true?
Possibly. And I think more so with particular poets than others. There is a mystery to poetry, and there is an intrigue to poetry. Poetry is not a didactic form. And so hopefully in a good poem, the reader will come into the essence and the nuances of the poem through their own reading abilities rather than being hammered over the head with something. So it's not as though you're directing when you're composing the poems. It's as though you're presenting enough threads, enough associative leaps, enough image-related work or image-ridden work so that the reader gathers the sensibilities in and of their own volition and comes into that mystery and embodies it themselves. And that's the actual function of the poem, is to coerce that in some way. But there's also reader response that varies. It's all very subjective. And so depending on what you're using for technique or skill or craft at the time, the reading itself or the essence of the reading may propel that. It may cause more distancing for certain audience members who are not comfortable with moving into things. But those are the same audience members that might not be comfortable watching a certain film that would allow you that same type of entry, or listening to a certain piece of music, jazz or classical music, that would allow that same type of subtle entry into this other known, that you come into it slowly and of your own volition. Hopefully you're presenting the threads to allow that to happen without, again, beating them over the head with it. Does that help at all?
A little bit.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, there, with that bit of mystery, we'll have to finish. Our guest, Alison Hedgecoke, holds the Paul W. Reynolds and Clarice Kingston Reynolds Endowed Chair at the University of Nebraska-Kearney, where she directs the Reynolds Reading Series. She's visiting the campus. Her visit here is part of the Carr Reading Series. Want to find out more about that? Visit the website of the U of I Creative Writing Program. And if you'd like to hear from her, reading from her memoir, Rock, Ghost, Willow, Deer, and also the collection Blood Run, stop by the Author's Corner at the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4:30, and you will be welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and come out to University of Nebraska at Kearney for our really crane conference. Come out and see the cranes.
We're here now for a couple of minutes, and then we'll make a way for the ag update, and we'll have some news, and then we'll have more in the next part of Focus 580. We all want to remind people who are listening that WILL programs are made possible with support from the Art Mart in Lincoln Square,
Urbana. The Art Mart offers unique items for the home and kitchen and a deli and bakery featuring Reuben's chocolates. Art Mart is pleased to support public radio. A lot of people are pleased to support public radio. I hope you will be, you listening will be among them. And if not, this would be a great opportunity for you to step up and do that. Here in the studio with me this morning is Dave Teal, who is the program director for WYLL TV.
Good morning, David Inge. We are David and David this morning. Right now, we, of course, are in the middle of a three-day pledge drive. This is day one. We're hoping to hear from at least 250 listeners during these 3 days. And so far, actually, we're doing very well. Actually, you're doing very well. 54 pledges so far. Most of them over the phone, a few of them over the web at our pledge site, our secure website, willpledge.org. And that's terrific. One of the benefits this morning and throughout this drive until we reach that magic number of 250 is that we have a partnership with the Common Ground Food Co-op, and they are going to donate enough money for three meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank with each pledge that we receive. And so your pledge goes even that much further. It helps support great programming here, Focus 580 and the Afternoon Magazine and Morning Edition, but it also helps feed some hungry people in the area, courtesy of the Common Ground Food Co-op and the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So we want to hear from you right now at 217-244-9455. You can be contributor number, 55 on our way to 250 over these 3 days. It is so important that we hear from you. We cannot do these programs without you.